of our special speakers in a series of consultations on Hispanic-American studies. And this evening we are privileged to hear Professor Richard Miller. You've seen the brochures, so I don't have to repeat everything that's on here. And Professor Miller from Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville fills too many positions and wears too many hats for me to narrate them all. He is also, by the way, and this should be of interest to every serious student here at an institution like Concordia Seminary, one of the founders, one of the vice presidents, and also on the editorial board of Fides and History, which is an organization of Christian historians at colleges and universities scattered all over the country. I also happen to be a member of that, so I've got some familiarity with this organization. Dr. Millett came in and told me that he had assumed that the whole presentation was in Spanish. And for a minute I thought I'd have to go back to my old overseas days here, but totally unequipped. The only Spanish I know is two words, which is un poco. Which is precisely what that means, I think, something like that. But without any further ado, let me present to you Dr. Richard Millett, who will announce his own topic and do his own thing.
I'd like to see that brochure. He can let me out. I'm more curious about what happened.
There you go. I'm also editor of the Bulletin of the Inter-American Association for the Study of Religion. Anybody who's interested in religion in Latin America and has $2 is welcome to become a member. The $2 is even more important than the interest. That's one of the last bargains left in the world, really. And with that, you get a free subscription to this beautiful bulletin, which you can mimeograph 3 or 4 times a year. And not much else. Privilege of attending meetings, which you could attend anyway if you weren't a member on the ground, so that anybody wants to attend, but you probably wouldn't know about if you didn't subscribe to this. Join with the seminary library. $2 a year. I'll give you the ad. $2 doesn't go to me. That's the reason I can advertise. As editor, I get a total budget of $2 a year for secretarial help and postage. That is, I pay my own dues to myself and buy postage stamps. My topic tonight is, I've chosen to call the Peril of Success, Post-World War II Latin American Protestantism. And I'll set out my thesis briefly and then try to detail it. What I'm talking about is the fact that Latin American Protestants, up until the Second World War, had a certain self-image. A self-image is a small, persecuted minority, basically isolated, basically uninfluential. And they had an image of what would constitute success. In many cases, the idea of even being legally tolerated constituted overwhelmingly success, of even being free to preach, free to meet, of not being discriminated against in the school. The idea of achieving 1, 2, or 3% of the population in many places would have seemed incredible success. I'll then try to demonstrate how almost all the criteria of success, as they would have been judged in those years, have been reached, and in many cases incredibly exceeded in the 30 years since the end of World War II, really in the last quarter century, we'll say, 50. And yet how this very achievement of success has created with it an entirely new set of problems previously undreamed of, problems which have in some ways made some people sort of nostalgic, like we get every now and then, for the earlier good old days when at least you knew where everybody stood. So now, I'll read some of it. I'll try to avoid reading too closely the text, which can occasionally put people to sleep, especially at evening meetings. The past 3 decades have witnessed remarkable growth in both the size and influence of Latin America's Protestant community. Accompanied by major alterations within the Roman Catholic Church, these changes have served to shatter the area's image as a center of religious stagnation and traditionalism. And departing from my text, that was a really powerful image. One reason I've managed to do as much as I have in religion in Latin America, I'm trained as a specialist in Latin American militarism. I made a logical transition to studying the Jesuits, but beyond that.
is that nobody would be trained in this area unless you're interested in colonial architecture or the Inquisition or something. I mean, Latin America's contemporary church 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 10 years ago when I was in grad school was considered dead.
Who wanted to study that?
It's changed completely. Protestantism's new strength and influence represents a degree of success virtually unimagined before World War II. With this success, however, has come a host of new problems and responsibilities, and efforts to deal with these have been only partially successful at best, and often have produced even further fragmentation of an already badly divided evangelical community. Now, in 1916, there were less than 100,000 Protestant communicants in all of South America, another 10,000 in Central America, and 22,000 in Mexico. Not exactly overwhelming figures. And a high percentage of these were immigrants, people whose Protestantism was effectively insulated. This would include especially the Lutherans. That is, they were outside the mainstream of Latin American culture. They practiced their religion. They made no effort to influence the rest of society. They were content to be left alone. In fact, their entire struggle often was to be left alone by the rest of society. Up to the 1930s, though, Protestantism experienced steady but unspectacular growth. And during this period, you saw the first of the independent indigenous Pentecostal churches. By the end of the 30s, the Protestant community, and now we have to talk about community because the great majority of Protestants in Latin America are Anabaptists in one sense or another. They baptize them. And they're very much stricter about it than most American Protestants. Sometimes it's amazing to get into some of these churches. You know, you have to really, you've got to, you know, it's sort of like joining the Communist Party. In a sense, you go through a candidate membership period. You know, you've got to prove yourself. You've got to prove you're living right. You've got to prove you're now you're not getting drunk every 5 hours or something like you used to. If you're in Haiti, you've got to prove that you have totally stopped participating in food worship. And then, if you've gone through all these candidate things, then you'll be in the membership. So we'll talk about a Protestant community which is several times the size of a membership. And the most accurate way of getting this is to going to people and saying, you know, what do you consider yourself? Are you Protestant or Catholic? You have common census figures that do this. Church data is sometimes unreliable, partly because so many people also go to several churches and every church counts them on their rolls. So we talk about estimates here. Achieving even this limited growth was not easy. Protestants often encountered determined and at times violent opposition from local Roman Catholics. Their churches were usually tiny and isolated, their members drawn heavily from the lower class, their denominational organizations foreign controlled and often dependent upon external financial support. Immigrant churches, as we noted, especially in Brazil and Argentina, reacted by isolating themselves. This was a defensive mechanism to survive. They continued to use their own national language, usually German, and made little of any effort to win converts from the surrounding population. Missionary churches, on the other hand, adopted a completely opposite tactic. That is, they were highly defensive in their self-image, viewing themselves as a tiny, persecuted minority, contending bravely for the true faith against the awesome powers of evil, powers which in turn were usually identified with Roman Catholicism. Very much a one-to-one identification here. Now, they had no doubt as to who the beast in the book of Revelation was, whatsoever. The only argument people see the Pope in Rome or the local bishop, you can get into an argument for this. But they were sure where it came from. Most were militantly anti-Catholic then. They denounced the church as idolatrous and debased, accused it of offering superstition in place of faith, exploiting the poor, and supporting all the ills which beset Latin America. Catholics responded in kind, denouncing Protestants as heretics, perverters of the social order, and classifying them with communism, spiritualism, and materialism as threats to the future of the hemisphere. There was a saying, you know, that ayer católico, hoy evangélico, mañana comunista. No, yesterday you were Catholic, today you were Protestant, tomorrow you'll be a communist. I made that statement in a meeting on Creative History Month. It was transcribed and published by somebody who didn't speak Spanish, or who spoke one of the reading words, somebody who had two lessons in Spanish, and never recovered. And it was published this way under my name, you know, making me look like the world's number one idiot, which I can do without help from editors. It said, yesterday, evangelico, today, Catholic, tomorrow, I said, comunista. She knew that was a Spanish word, it was como esta, which means how are you? So,
Occasionally we have trouble with editors, but it's como misa, not como está.
In the mid-1940s, an Argentine archbishop reportedly even went so far as to declare, quote, Argentina is a Catholic country. Those who abandon Catholicism are traitors, and traitors are shot in the back, unquote. This constant struggle with Catholicism encouraged Protestants to focus what limited political influence they could muster upon church-state relations. The issues often appeared deceptively simple. If an administration was pro-Catholic, restricting Protestant activities, making Catholic religious instruction compulsory in the schools, Protestants opposed it and often attacked such governments in their publications in the United States and in Latin America. Support was given to liberal regimes, which often meant anti-clerical. Efforts were made to counter Catholic attacks upon such governments, as exemplified during certain phases of the Mexican Revolution. And any opportunities offered by such regimes for increasing Protestant activities were usually warmly accepted. This alliance with the liberal party, combined with the polemical nature of many Protestant critiques of the traditional social structure, a structure which was intimately identified with the Catholic Church, gave evangelicals something of a progressive anti-establishment image. Protestant schools became noted centers for training liberal, even radical leadership. The depth of any commitment to liberalism by the majority of Protestants is open to serious question, though. Beyond involvement in church-state issues, most involved political involvement, perhaps because their minority status and dependence upon foreign support, made the risks of any such involvement unacceptably high. Here again, I think we're striking a fascinating sort of thing. I suppose nothing really gets people more than to discover that the fundamentalists in Latin America were being attacked as allies of the communists. And to discover that even as recently as the election of Salvador Allende, the great majority of Chilean Pentecostals voted for the Marxist candidate. Now this is not the kind of image that fundamentalism tends to create in the United States, with people going around voting for Marxists, allied with communists, and surging their schools as centers for training radical leaders. But you have to realize the entire political context. Liberal meant anti-clerical. Anti-clerical meant we can survive. The relatively extensive social programs of many Protestant groups often contributed to this image. Most of their pre-World War II medical and social welfare programs, however, were taken predominantly to win converts. And a similar motive was responsible for much of their educational work, although this also served to make available for the children of both missionaries and converts schools where Roman Catholicism was not taught. This was an important alternative function. Dependence upon foreign support, combined with militant rejection, not only of Catholicism, but of the cultural values associated with the church, often produced a form of cultural alienation among the evangelicals. They created their own subculture, often imitating Anglo-Saxon models. In this regard, they conformed to one of the worst aspects of late 19th and early 20th century Latin American liberalism, its tendency to reject the hemisphere's own cultural and social heritage and to seek instead to develop the area along European or North American lines. This attitude shaped the church's internal practices as well as their external attitudes. Services became virtual carbon copies of foreign middle-class models. Hymns were usually direct and often awkward translations from English language hymnals. There is nothing worse to me than hearing Fanny Crosby sung off-key in Spanish. And I'm particularly fond of Fanny Crosby in English, I'll admit, but in Spanish it's hideous. And yet this was imposed directly. As one person once observed, though, that American church music was written for the organ and the piano, and the Latin instrument was the guitar. And but you didn't do this. You made them get a piano, even though they couldn't afford it, or you sang with nothing. Maybe just the fact that Pentecostals wouldn't use guitars was one reason why they had much more success than some of the traditional churches. Seminaries and Bible schools, too, followed curriculums based on somewhat simplified models of those used in North American institutions. And here we have cultural imperialism at one of its more, I think, destructive ways. It was sort of a way of telling the Latin, we really know you're not capable of learning everything that's going to go good. So we'll give you a simple model. The Marines did the same thing. They trained officers for Latin American armies by putting them through the 3-month school required for non-commissioned sergeants in the Marine Corps. This made you capable of being a Latin lieutenant or captain. This kind of, not very subtle, really, conferring a second-class citizenship. And then you can always say, well, they don't understand theology as well, because
look at their training. You know, but who designed their training? Well, the people who later went around and said, well, they don't understand theology well enough to argue with us. You've got a very complex kind of thing going. You've got a very destructive one. Exceptionally promising students at times did receive advanced education in the United States a year, always out of Latin America. But upon returning to Latin America, they were usually employed by foreign missions or service organizations at a subordinate level, control of such organizations remaining firmly in missionary hands. It is therefore not surprising that as recently as 20 years ago, Latin American Protestants have produced no distinctive theology, social commentary, or philosophy. But in the past quarter century, several important developments have forced a major re-examination of this traditional position and self-image. The most obvious factor has been rapid growth. By 1974, the total Protestant community in Latin America probably numbers somewhere in excess of 20 million people. Now that is pretty rapid. There are more Pentecostals in Brazil than there are in the United States. There are today, on any given Sunday, more Protestants in church in Haiti, in Chile, and possibly in Brazil than there are Catholics, because Protestants tend to go to church. That situation was, you know, utterly inconceivable a few years ago. And it's still bluntly inconceivable to some of my colleagues in Latin American studies, who just shake their heads over this sort of thing. This great increase in size has been accompanied by a significant change in composition. Growth rates of most traditional denominations, Methodists, Presbyterians, Lutherans, have lagged well behind the rate for the region as a whole. Churches sponsored by non-denominational faith missions have done somewhat better, but by far the most spectacular increases were recorded by two groups, the Pentecostals and the Seventh-day Adventists. If you want an unstudied area for the Seventh-day Adventists, I made my first contact, my first opportunity to study this, in the past month. It's really been hard. Probably they have not previously encouraged anybody to come and study them. But they are a totally neglected area. And in some countries, they're the most numerous group, for example, in Haiti. As recently as 15 years ago, most studies of Latin American Protestantism made little, if any, reference to Pentecost. Today, any such study which did not devote extensive attention to these churches would be of extremely limited value, since they now make up about 60% of these 20 million Protestants. And you can probably toss in another 10% for Adventists. A large percentage of the Pentecostals belong to churches which are wholly indigenous, free of any ties with foreign churches. Their strength, along with that of the Adventists, has led many of the more traditional denominations to a critical re-examination of their programs of outreach and worship. The changes in influence and self-image produced by this growth are even greater than statistics indicate. Much of Latin American Catholicism is nominal. Guatemala's bishop, who's a friend of mine, recently told me that he thought the majority of people in his country came to church only, as he put it, to be hashed, matched, and dispatched. Christened, married, and buried. And that was it. And that another priest in Peru said, we've been baptizing spiritual animals here for 300 years and never getting them beyond that stage. With priestly vocations declining within the Roman Catholic Church, there are many countries where Protestants, though a small minority, have a clergy that outnumbers the Catholic Church. For instance, Honduras. Protestants form less than 3% of Honduras' population. There are more Protestant ministers in Honduras than there are Catholic priests. And the percentage of foreign priests is higher than the percentage of foreign Protestant ministers. So, you know, in terms of indigenous, there's probably two indigenous Protestant ministers for every indigenous priest. In a country that's 3% Protestant, 95% Catholic, 2% confused. Along with the increase in strength has come a distinct rise in social status and political influence. 30 years ago, a Protestant professional or government official was something of a rarity. Today, there are Protestant occupying important positions in virtually every nation of the hemisphere. And the most conspicuous example, unfortunately, is Brazil, where the president, four of the 21 state governors before the last election, and several members of the Congress are Protestant. While this rapid growth in size and influence has undermined their self-image as a member of a small persecuted minority, the ecumenical movement and the effects of Vatican II have provided a tremendous challenge to their traditional anti-Catholicism. The mutual anathemas of the first half of the century have been largely replaced by a growing dialogue. Formerly bitterly condemned as herejes, heretics, Protestants are now classified as hermanos separados, separated brothers,
with more emphasis often being placed upon the hermano than upon the separado. I was talking to a good friend of mine who's a bishop of Chiapas, Samuel Ruiz Garcia, a leading progressive bishop of the Catholic Church. He invited me to a meeting with his priest, and he was referring to me as nuestro hermano. And I said, soy evangélico, pero eso soy hermano separado. He said, sí, separado por la mesa. We're sitting on different sides of the table. separated by the table. Yeah, now again, there are some who would see me separated as a lot more than that. There are some who find it incredibly difficult, you know, to simply smile when the Protestant passes on the street. But this is, again, some of the older generation. It's at least equally, if not more, difficult for some of the Protestants. Not all Protestants have found these changes easy to accept. Some conservatives have warned that Protestant-Catholic dialogue threatens unity among evangelicals, and it may cause converts to question why they ever left the Catholic Church. For others, the reality of the ecumenical movement has come as a distinct personal shock. One of my favorite stories, I met a young Protestant missionary who was very conservative church and studying at the Language Institute in Coast City, one of the places where they train Protestant missionaries in Spanish. And he got enough Spanish to go out in the countryside for the first time. And he's going to go out and sell Bibles. Now, he'd come from Texas, and he knew about Catholics in Latin America. They all worshiped idols. They burned Protestants, you know, and do rock tests. Anybody caught reading the Bible was liable to be put on the rack by the Inquisition. He knew. So he had this copy of Dios Llegará al Hombre, which is the Spanish predecessor to Good News for Modern Man. The line drawings in Good News for Modern Man come from the Spanish version, are all stolen by the medieval imperials. If they originated the Spanish version, they really did. It was just called Dios Llegará al Hombre, God arrives in one man. He got out to this little town in Costa Rica. He began to unload his box with New Testaments to give out door to door. And there in the distance came the figure, which is arch enemy, Satan's brother in his black robe. He walked up to him and said, in Spanish, what are you doing here? He knew enough Spanish to answer. Now, you know, his time for martyrdom would come sooner than he thought. You know? So he said, he stood bravely there and he said, I'm here to give the people the word of God. And he held a copy of the New Testament. And the priest said, wonderful! I'll ring the church bell in front of my congregation. They can help you distribute it. I saw this guy about 3 days later. Total cultural shock. He could not comprehend what had happened. The last thing the priest was supposed to do was ring the church bell and hang out the New Testament. And I told him that was nothing but Franciscans had been distributing it themselves throughout the coastal area of Costa Rica for 2 years. I think he went home on the next bus to Texas, but this has really produced cultural shock for the Protestants. I mean, how do you react to this? You knew how to react when they threw stones at you. That's easy, you duck. You know, what do you do when they want to hand out your translation of the New Testament? One area in which many Catholics have sought dialogue and even cooperation with Protestants has been in developing a response to the hemisphere's ever-deepening socioeconomic crisis. But responses here, too, have deeply divided the Protestant community. Traditional social service programs are obviously totally inadequate, yet efforts to define new, more active programs of social action have led to highly divisive conflicts. Growing pressure for radical change from the political left, coupled with increasingly violent repression from the right, have served to further aggravate the situation. Problems have also arisen in Protestant church bodies as a result of a growing spirit of nationalism. This has limited the effectiveness of North American missionaries, especially in pastoral ministries, and has increasingly freed Latin leaders to question and criticize foreign programs. This, in turn, is forcing a long overdue re-examination of the basically paternalistic relationships which have existed between many Latin churches and denominational authorities or mission boards in the United States. These aforementioned developments have created a critical need for the evangelicals to redefine their position within society. The urgency of this task varies from nation to nation, being less in a relatively static society such as Paraguay than it is in the more modernized and urbanized environment of, say, Argentina. But the necessity is clearly present in every nation. Divisions along national, denominational, and especially political theological lines, however, have made it virtually impossible to achieve any consensus on the church's role in contemporary society. Many fundamentalist evangelicals continue to resist all pressures for altering traditional positions. They often echo North American conservative arguments,
which equates social activism with modernism in theology and communism in politics. Funniest thing now is to be these people talking about Protestants and communism. Complete reversal. Their churches are also highly suspicious in their approaches to other denominations, viewing any deviation from their peculiar doctrine as dangerously heretical. But due in part to their own self-imposed isolation, their influence is rather small. Some Pentecostal groups fall in the above category. Many find themselves in a somewhat more open position, surprising enough in regard to ecumenical as well as social programs. Pentecostal groups from Latin America that have joined the World Council of Churches, from Brazil and Chile, although not the largest group in Brazil. Unlike many of the older denominations who have found that success has often transformed them into increasingly middle-class churches, alienated from the mass of the population, the Pentecostals have managed to retain a rather intimate identification with the lower class. This is vital. Their ministers are largely drawn from that segment of society, and they usually live in or near their churches, which are generally located within lower class neighborhoods. This continuing class identification means that their appreciation of the material as well as the spiritual needs of their congregation is experienced directly, not simply understood intellectually. I know a Pentecostal minister in Mexico. He has a master's degree. He has published in International Religious Encyclopedias out of Germany. He's written a book. And this man lives in one of the poorer working class neighborhoods of Mexico City above his church, in an area where I would not go at night. There are areas I wouldn't go in the daytime, so at least I go at night. It is a rough area. He lives in poor surroundings. This guy corresponds with people all over the world. Not any traditional denomination minister would achieve this kind of success, this kind of education, would be working for the denomination, would be living in the middle class area, would have six servants in the house in a Latin American setting, Indian Federation, maybe three. Would be totally alienated in a sense, and he would dress differently. He would dress like I dress. He would be viewed as differently. He would be viewed as the outsider coming into this community. This man is not, although he's achieved the education. He has retained the identification. And it's something no other group has been able to do. The actual role of Pentecostals in promoting meaningful social change has been the subject of considerable debate. And I could go into this. I find the most interesting position that of Orlando Costa. Orlando Costa of Puerto Rico, of the Seminario Bíblico of Costa Rica, who takes a moderating position, giving Pentecostals credit for producing an individual liberating effect, but criticizing their inability to translate their concern for individuals into meaningful social involvement. Part of the disagreement over the social role of Pentecostals may be due to the wide variety of leadership and social doctrine in the movement. An interesting example here is the Brasil para Cristo movement, headed by the very charismatic Manuel de Mello. This church has encouraged political involvement as much as you're allowed to in Brazil, has opened orphanages, hospitals, and schools, and to the astonishment and consternation of some, even joined the World Council of Churches. De Mello explained this last action by expressing a need to join with other Christians in order to attack social problems. He was quoted as saying, quote, "What good does it do to convert a million people if at the same time the devil unconverts 10 million through hunger, disease, and military dictatorship?" He's not a Calvinist. These sort of things one can't overcome by holding wonderful religious services, but by organizing one's forces and joining with others who have similar interests. If nothing else, this quote serves to illustrate that a very real potential for social action does exist within the Pentecostal churches. The problems produced by the collapse of traditional self-image and the change in the social status of Protestants is most clearly seen within the older denominations. This would include immigrant churches, such as the Lutherans, Mennonites, and Waldensians, mainline Protestants, notably Methodists, Presbyterians, Episcopals, and Baptists, and some of the churches fostered by the larger, older, interdenominational missions. These groups share several common situations. First, while many are still growing at a rate near to the rate of national population growth, their relative strength within the Protestant community has steadily declined in recent decades. They also face the problem of an emerging second generation, new to Latin America, born into Protestantism, not converted from Catholicism, and never having known persecution by Catholicism personally, never having experienced this sort of thing. Or in the case of immigrant churches, born into a Latin rather than a European environment. In both cases, the ties of the second generation traditional church patterns are weaker than those of their parents, while their concern for national problems is usually stronger. Among immigrant groups, there is a growing pressure to hold services in the national language and to integrate the church into the national community. In all these groups, there is a growing questioning of traditional paths. At the 1969 Latin American Conference on Evangelism, Professor Samuel Escobar of Peru quoted a Protestant youth to say, "In the past, they told us, don't worry about changing society because what we need is to change men. New men will change society. But when the new men begin to worry about changing society, they are told not to worry. The world has always been bad. We await new heavens and a new earth. And if this world is condemned to destruction, why try to make it better? What's even worse is that those who teach this are the ones who enjoy all the advantages that this passing world offers, and they passionately defend them whenever they are in danger." Another common factor for many of these churches is their increasing identification with the middle class. According to Orlando Costas, this means that most Latin American evangelicals who do recognize the need for social action and justice strive to achieve this within the framework of an ideology of change which responds to the interests of the middle class. This is combined with a traditional approach to social problems, which is highly individualistic and moralist, expressing drunkenness, sexual vices, and various forms of popular amusements as the great evils of society. I was staying with some Protestants in Panama, and I was going to go out one evening to the National Folk Ballet, and they were terrified, because that was the epitome, dance, folk dancing. That was associated with drunken festivals. How could you go to the Ballet Folklorico? Now, this is totally native to national culture, but this kind of view, they did some other things where converts changed. Every time before they went for a drive, they all prayed fervently. And then when I'd ridden around the Panama streets for a while, I joined them. Even when hunger, disease, and illiteracy are added to this list of social problems, there remains a clear tendency to concentrate on treating the symptoms while ignoring the structural bias of society which produced existing conditions. The weakness of most Protestant social action programs is aggravated by an acute shortage of capable, educated pastoral leadership. As the social and educational level of many congregations has risen, the need for a better qualified clergy has also increased. But neither the manpower nor the monetary resources needed have been forthcoming. Efforts to solve this by expanding and upgrading traditional seminary facilities have been somewhat less than successful. And the Lutherans, as you know, are involved in two of these efforts. Instituto Superior de Estudios Teológicos, Institute of Superior Theological Studies in Buenos Aires, created by a merger of the Lutheran and Reformed and Union Seminary, and the seminary community in Mexico City, where people who are graduates from Concordia, Glenn Stahlke and Robert Hooperkamp, are teaching right at the moment. Recently, though, the Buenos Aires complex had only 46 full-time students to go with its faculty of 14 full-time and 11 part-time instructors. Now that's our good faculty-student ratio. But it would seem to indicate that you're not reaching the total Protestant community. The graduates of such seminaries often find that there are few churches which can or will support ministers with their educational and social qualifications. An argument I've been making for years that we have been busily engaged in creating ministers for non-existent middle-class churches. In addition, the relatively liberal education which they have received tends to alienate many of them from the membership of their own denomination. I'm talking about liberal, in the traditional liberal education sense. As a result, many, if not most, of the best graduates go into administrative or teaching positions or leave church work altogether. Efforts to provide additional leadership have taken other forms. Some major urban churches, unable to obtain qualified national pastors, have turned to Cuban exiles, local seminary profs, Puerto Ricans, and even former North American missionaries. One answer to this has been the movement to theology, theological education by extension, which we could devote a lot of time to, but I think there are others better qualified. But despite such efforts, the problems of recruiting and supporting pastoral leadership remains acute throughout the hemisphere. The necessity of turning control of Protestant work over to Latins has been recognized by all of the most conservative and isolated groups. When I discovered the Southern Baptists were talking about it, I knew it had penetrated everywhere. But efforts to act upon this have produced a multitude of problems. First, there is a wonderful tendency who have built a vast infrastructure. You have built the Latins, a big seminary, you know, the heavy faculty of Greek students. You've built them three hospitals, a bunch of primary schools, three rural dispensaries, and then you say, now you're going to be free, we're going to take away our money, and you support this. Well, there is no way they can support this kind of infrastructure. It is absolutely, it is proportionately much higher than the infrastructure of social works that the American churches maintain in their own country. And yet the average per capita income of the Latin church members is probably one-tenth of what the American church member is, and they leave this kind of thing behind for them. In fact, at times it's also an excuse simply for cutting back. In other cases, major conflicts have arisen over programs of social action. Interestingly enough, in several of these disputes, it's been the Americans who had advocated more aggressive social action and have diverted resources into support of activist socio-political organizations whose connections with the Latin American church is tenuous at best. Colombia is a beautiful example of this. Finally, there is a marked reluctance on the part of many American churches to transfer support from an American missionary whom they often know from a Latin whom they have never met. As one Ecuadorian Protestant leader, whom I will leave anonymous, told me, and rather bitterly expressed it, most North Americans seem only interested in sending their money to other North Americans who come back from time to time to entertain them with photographs of naked Indians. In some ways, a very perceptive comment. We've really found this. You can find a Latin who can do three times the work for half the money. But, he's not one of our boys. And both to make grudging support and providing he agrees to take the time, the expense, and all of that to come back and make the circuit, entertain them every few years. This is resentment. I think justifiably so. At times, church boards have approached movements towards nationalizing church leadership with suspicion and fear. Their programs have often been characterized by a heavy-handed paternalism. The parent denomination or board, while paying lip service to a necessity for indigenous leadership and an end to dependency relations, at the same time demands that it have final judgment on the pace of transition, the financial involvements involved, and in some cases even the selection of the national leaders who will assume control. The bitterness produced by such attitudes should not be endorsed. Sit there and say, we're going to tell you when you're ready to be an adult. Anytime you've experienced that, at home yourselves or with your kids, and it does not exactly produce you. I'll tell you, when you're ready to be free. And I'll tell you how you can be free, and under what terms it will be your leader. And this will leave you free and independent. What it leaves you is bitter and divided. The pressure of responding to change both within and outside of the Protestant community has produced serious division, as well as causing conflict between missions and indigenous leadership. A small but active minority, including many of the most educated Latin churchmen, have called in recent years for the church to take radical action in favor of social justice. While present for years, this group's emergence as a significant factor can probably be dated from the Wambani Conference on the Responsibility of the Protestant Church in the Face of Rapid Social Changes, held in Peru during July 1961. Out of this emerged the Latin American Board on Church and Society, Iglesia Sociedad America Latina, or ISAL, located in Uruguay, which has served as an organizational center for studies and publications advocating increasingly active and radical roles for the churches of the hemisphere. In 1963, ISAL began publishing its journal, Cristianismo y Sociedad, Christianity and Society, which provided a forum for further dissemination of such arguments throughout Latin America. All of this, there have been additional conferences since, have alarmed conservative church leaders who responded by attacking the proposals advanced to ISAL, accusing its spokesman of theological liberalism and political alliance with Marxism. In the late 1960s, a bitter dispute broke out over the selection of programming delegates for the Third Latin American Evangelical Congress. After repeated postponements, it was finally held in Buenos Aires, but many conservative denominations boycotted the meeting. The resultant arguments over social action ecumenical ties seemed to signal an almost complete split within Latin American Protestantism. Later in 1969, the conservative groups conducted their own conference on evangelism in Bogotá. To the surprise of many, several speakers openly criticized the church's lack of meaningful social involvement. Their remarks received generally favorable responses from the 920 delegates. I should say generally favorable. bluntly, the North Americans received them less favorably than the Latin Americans. The missionaries often set in their hands while the Latin got up and cheered, and that said something, you know. And we're shocked the Latin got up and cheered, which shows you how much real communication had been going on. The concluding Declaración Evangélica de Bogotá declared, "The hour has come for evangelicals to become aware of our social responsibility. The extent to which the activities of ESAL have influenced this belated recognition is questionable. Whatever the cause, this discussion and self-criticism, once begun, has continued and expanded with each passing year. And in the recent conference on evangelism in Lausanne, in Switzerland, we'll note again who made the sensation, whose speech was it, and fascinating to note again people who didn't want to talk about it, who did, were people like René Padilla, of Ecuador, who's not the Ecuadorian I quoted earlier, but René Padilla, who works for the International Fellowship of Evangelical Students, who again got up and bitterly attacked some of the ties of traditional American Western evangelicalism with oppressive social structure." And I've had some fascinating reports from both Latin and North American delegates here. Occasionally you feel they attended two different conferences. But you've got a real division here. Division on attitude, division on response. And the most tragic thing was that a lot of the North Americans just didn't understand what Rennie was complaining about. But I admit to me, Latin, even if he didn't agree with him, he didn't understand it. "While the gap between conservative and liberal church factions," and liberal here you'd better put in quotes, they really aren't very liberal, "has by no means been healed by events since 69, the near total polarization which seemed to be developing has apparently been at least delayed, if not halted. A moderate faction, including such notable figures as José Miguel Bonino of Iseret and Samuel Escobar, president of the conservative Fraternidad Teológica Latinoamericana, both of whom were on the executive council along with me at the Inter-American Association for the Study of Religion and Commercial, has begun to emerge, seeking a means of adequately expressing both traditional theological concerns and active social involvement. Criticism of American policy or of cultural dependency created by various missions has become a not uncommon topic at conferences sponsored by conservative as well as liberal Protestants." You even have books by people such as Juan Seitz called The Other Side of the Coin, which, while he approaches it very gingerly, it's available in English. Who published that? Not Erdman. Somebody in more conservative than Erdman. Word or Moody? No, Moody wouldn't publish it, but somebody's more conservative. "Despite such developments, the basic differences within Latin American Protestantism have not and are not likely to be overcome in the foreseeable future. There are theological as well as methodological issues involved. It may well be that the emergence of moderates within both liberal and conservative ranks may actually be a sign of more splintering rather than an indication of any real movement towards reconciliation or consensus among competing ideologies. One thing, however, is certain. The days of ideological and social stagnation within Latin America's Protestant community have definitely ended. Over the past few decades, the perils of success have become increasingly clear for Latin American Protestants. The simple formula by which they could gauge response to most social and political situations and could tell friend from foe, largely on the basis of their attitudes towards Catholicism, are gone forever. Growth and responsibility have brought conflict, fragmentation, and tension rather than peace and unity. But with the problems have come new opportunities and new resources. For the first time, Protestants have both the numbers and the indigenous leadership to make a major contribution to Latin America's future. The continuing struggle to develop a Protestant community, which is authentically Latin, relating to rather than denying its cultural heritage and its own national problems, and which is also free of foreign control, free to adapt from other sources and ideologies, but also free to develop its own distinctive approaches to the shaping of the hemisphere's future, and finally, which is authentically evangelical, which is committed to Protestantism, which is committed to Christianity as a guiding force for change." And this is incidentally a slogan which I found really has caught on. La lucha, the struggle for a church which is Latino, Latin, libre, free, evangelical, and evangelical. The extent to which the struggle is successful will undoubtedly continue for many years. But upon the outcome of this struggle, with the perils of success will rest the future of Protestantism in Latin America. Thank you. Now, I would be very glad to answer questions, and I would hope I've aroused it.
Will
be
happy to field some questions
on
this.
I don't know
where the tomato confessions in the back. Yeah. I would hope there are some. Does
the Roman Catholic Church kind of encourage or is glad to see Protestants having some success because they recognize that they, by default, they can't handle themselves? Or how do they react to this?
Well, first of all, it's very hard to speak of the Roman Catholic Church anymore. The divisions within the Catholic Church are astonishing. It used to be, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, if you wanted to hear nasty stories about Catholic bishops, of course, you went to the Protestants. They tell you all of them. Now you go to the Protestants and they say, oh, the Catholics, you know, they're trying to be accommodating. And you hear nasty stories, you go to the priests. They'll tell you about bishops. I remember once I heard the editor of the largest Catholic paper in the country was bitterly complaining about the archbishop. And I said, you know, Es como un hombre del siglo XIX. He sounds like a guy from the 19th century. Edgar got mad. He said, no, no, he's not. He's from the 16th
century. So this is, and you get much worse than this. Some of these stories really get screwed up sometimes. But these are being spread by Catholic priests.
One of my best friends, a Jesuit in Mexico City, is writing a book bitterly attacking the church sustained in abortion. I don't know how much longer he'll be a Jesuit. And it's going to be published by the Jesuit publishing house in Mexico City. That's going to be fun. I don't know how they're going to get an imprimatur on that, but they're going to find a way. The church is so divided in so many ways that it's very hard to say about a Catholic position. In some ways, the Catholics are glad. In some ways, they're trying to learn. The Catholics, much more than the traditional Protestant denominations, have tried to learn from the Pentecostals. They talk now about making the church the pueblo de Dios. The people of God, you know, and of living with the people. I know Catholics, again, who are doing, they're the only people I know who are doing it. I know a Catholic PhD in France, brilliant, who is living in the poorest slum area of Mexico and working. Yeah. It's very kind of hard, you know, but they're trying to get back to this kind of thing, trying to cut off this isolation of clergy to this class identification of the church with the rich and the powerful. Very hard for them. Secondly, I know a lot of Protestant missionaries from some very conservative mission groups, which I better not mention. They, you know, and they certainly would never quote by name, but who will tell you privately that really they say our job here is no longer to win converts. You know, our job is to be God's catalyst. You know, to continue to produce changes in the Catholic Church by the fact that we offer examples, alternatives. But not to bring people out of the Catholic Church. This no longer makes sense. I will tell you also that in Costa Rica, I've heard students after students at things like the Seminario Biblico, one of the best conservative seminaries in Latin America, tell me that the only good evangelical sermons in town are preached in the Catholic Church. And this is for the local priest here. He's been taking out an image a month to be repaired. And they never are. One a month. Goes down to the cellar to be repaired. And he says, when you get to Mary and Jesus, you've got a problem. And they're the only two left. He doesn't know where he's going. You go to the cathedral in Cuernavaca, where they sing the Misa Panamericana every Sunday, where Sergio Mendez Acero is the bishop. Every side over has been closed, sealed up, and scripture quotes on banners hung there, either from the Beatitudes or mostly condemnations of exploiting the poor. This is a Catholic cathedral. There isn't a side over of the thing, just Bible verses. The change is authentic, and nobody's putting you on here. Yeah, Father?
If the upper classes in Latin America will be to be touched with the gospel, to which denomination do you think they will respond most?
I tend to be here and go back to 1 Corinthians. And I made a mistake of doing this. I spoke of it. What Presbyterian Church in Bethesda, which was known and layered in Mark Antwo's church and others. And I said, I point out that it says in Corinthians that God could use the poor and the weak and the foolish of this world, and that Americans should realize he qualified only one of those three counts. But
I don't think you're going to see the Roman Catholic Church itself is up to school. The upper classes in general are not
By anything. The upper class is an embattled class. It's also a very traditional class. The middle class is something else. The emerging entrepreneurial class. They're not reached by Pentecostalism. They are not reached by radical Catholicism in general. As males, they don't go to traditional Catholic services. Their wives go. But they don't go. And this is a matriarchal society. I mean, patriarchal society, not matriarchal, pardon me. It's matriarchal at home, but patriarchal in government, business, and everything else. The best chances there will probably be through the traditional denomination. You've got people there who can speak their language, who live where they are at, who have the education, and who now are also authentically enough Latin. And there is a real vacuum for this group in terms of ideology. They are departing from traditional ideology. They haven't found a new ideology bluntly yet that meets any of their needs. But they're a very cynical group. And I think, again, if your heritage is Latin, you have no great reason to be overwhelmingly positive about religion. Also, they're a very highly individualistic group, which is Latin, in general. This creates problems. Part of the middle class is largely come out from the traditional denomination. But they behave as a very conservative, very, very straight. There is the most middle class church services I've ever seen in my life are some of the Presbyterian and Methodist church services in Latin America. I mean, good grief, they make our churches look like, talk about the middle class of prayer here. Never seen many people sitting in suits so straight through a prayer that lasted 25 minutes. And then he began the sermon. But a 25-minute prayer. Everybody sat there in a suit. Now you could just... And the prayer was right straight out of 1910.
You referred several times to the middle class. Do you think the middle class is growing? We've often said this is a hope of stability there. Is it growing? Is it going to contribute to the stability of the countries down there?
Well, it's growing everywhere. The rate varies. Does it contribute to stability? I don't know.
We're especially being without a blackboard. I even brought my own chalk in case I needed it.
you've got a problem in that, a few years ago we had 2% upper class, 5% middle class, maybe, and we should say 3% upper class, and 92% lower class. And this has changed. The upper class maybe now is 4%. The big growth, this is now 20%. And this down here is 76%. Not much impressive. Except what's happened is that while this has gone on, the population hemisphere has doubled, which means the number of people down here is a heck of a lot larger. And that's where your problem is. Your middle class is growing in percentage. It's like, well, the literacy rate goes up, the number of illiterates in many countries is also going up. You were 30% literate 20 years ago, now you're 40% literate, but you've got a half million more illiterates. This is running to stand still. And it's a very divided, it's a very unsure of itself. You have some people divide the Latin American middle class into all sorts of different groups, a traditional middle class, and an entrepreneurial middle class, and a rising middle class. And where does organized labor fit in? Well, in some countries in Latin America, unionized labor is becoming middle class just like it is in the U.S. In other areas, it certainly is not. If this trend was to continue in this regard for another 100 years, maybe, but I don't think it's going to continue. I don't think, you just don't have the time. The numbers and the conditions that are piling up down here are too explosive. And it's like, I'm afraid what happens in the middle in many of the disputes, theological and otherwise, is they get destroyed. Middle class in Cuba, again, was growing and growing and growing with Fidel Roth. But proved a very weak degree of opposition. It divided. Some stayed behind and opposed the regime. Those who could took a plane to Florida. And some aligned themselves with it. But in terms of any special opposition, and of course, it wasn't the middle class that brought down the end, even though it's a very strong middle class country in Chile. It was there. It didn't do anything.
for very different reasons.
Yeah. Two questions. First, how did the priests change? Obviously, they have a much different attitude than they did 25 or 30 years ago.
Well, they're changing here, too.
Yes. Well,
but they're changing more rapidly in Latin America. They changed, first of all, because a lot of them were foreigners. What happened was you had a rediscovery right after World War II of Latin America, the Catholic mission field. Suddenly, the Catholics began to say what the Protestants have been saying all along. You had kind of a reformed form of heathen, you know. Really, we had a folk religion down here.
And the Pope called, well, there's a lot of students.
The Pope called, and I'm assuming when the master thesis on this now, you can't trace any of the quotes back. Everybody says they got them from somebody else. There's a call for several, you know, for a million foreign priests for Latin America, that kind of thing. You've got tens of thousands of foreign, or I should say foreign priests, brothers, working, etc. You've got tens of thousands of them shipped into Latin America. They were often appalled by what they found. There was a real effort to begin, for the first time, training indigenous clergy, recruiting them from the lower classes. They were trained by foreign priests. And the foreign priests often were coming out of Germany, France, when they were teaching at the seminary, and the Americans were out working in the rural areas and suffering cultural shock and occasionally joining the guerrillas. You know, this was really a shock for somebody who'd grown up in a nice Irish middle-class Catholic neighborhood to discover what the Catholic Church had been doing in Latin America for 300 years. This was not the Catholic Church he knew. So you had this influx of foreign clergy, which was part of it, and an influx of new ideas. Vatican II was part of it, but in a sense, you know, it opened windows. And the Latins had their own conference at Medellin, the Latin bishops, whose declarations were a lot more radical than anything Vatican II ever thought about. Of course, again, it was controlled by minorities of bishops, really the consultative committee that drew up most of the documents. The church in Latin America is a different problem. I had a Latin priest once say to me, and I think maybe this sums up why they're changing. He said, in Germany, the question for the church is, what is the latest theology? That's a good question for Germany. In France, you know, the question is, how do we dialogue with the Marxist work? And in the United States, the pressing issue is, how many guitars can you use in the mass? Which probably sums us up pretty well. And in the Latin American church, the question is, how do I help my congregation live through tomorrow? Now that gives you a very different focus. And this is where the whole new theology, the theology of liberation, although it has, to call that a theology is probably one of the worst misnomers we can do. There are multitudes of theologies of liberation. Some heavily Marxist historians, some very little Marxist historians. I mean, borrow certain Marxist models when they work to explain society, but that's all. They cover a wide range, but they say we reflect on our present condition. You get your theology by reflecting on man as he lives in society now, and how does God speak to man where he is today? Blacks in the immediate reality. This develops a wildly different church. A church was discovered it was losing, and set out to ask why. And some people came up with some very interesting answers.